Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 17th of October, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host this afternoon, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish. We don't normally start with an apology, but I'll give the apology. We're going to show a little bit of what Google has been doing, but this is in relation to the court case of Melanie Shaw. So let's have a look. Fascinating that after months and months and months of nothing about Melanie Shaw on Google, when you searched her story, you searched Nottingham child abuse, you searched for Beechwood home, all of the information had gone down. Nothing of the original stories from the Nottingham Post or the BBC or any of the other so-called mainstream media in including the big name papers, of course, The Telegraph and The Guardian, absolutely nothing. Melanie's now been through a particularly vile court hearing, and suddenly she's all over the internet. Just a coincidence, Mike.
Yeah, so first and second on the front page there. But has Melanie been through a court case?
Well, we're going to have a little bit of discussion about that, and let's just look at what's come out so far. And we'll go to the Nottingham Post because they've obviously taken great delight in reporting this. And so here we are. Here's the headline. Jury decides that Beechwood whistleblower Melanie Shaw set fire to her cell three times. The defence offered no evidence in the case. Shaw was deemed unfit to stand trial, so a finding of fact was conducted in her absence. The jury of five men and seven women took less than an hour to find that Shaw did the acts. They were instructed to reach a not guilty verdict on a further count of arson. So quite interesting reporting here, Mike, because they do say that she was absent, but then the whole style of the article is as if what was said had come out of the mouth of Melanie Shaw.
Well, OK, so, but first thing to notice here is that they're talking about a finding of fact, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later.
Indeed. So let's just get some of the key points up on screen. So Melanie was found guilty of arson charges. Now, understand the sentencing's the 15th of November 2018. I have seen the 12th of November reported in some places, but I think it's the 15th. People are very welcome to correct us on that. Melanie was not well enough to attend the Leeds Crown Court, nor did she testify by video. She was simply not present at her own court hearing, which was allegedly called a trial of facts, and the defence offered no further evidence. Now, what was actually going on here, Mike? A lot of people who attended the court case were totally bemused at how they could be a court case with a jury and no Melanie in court. I also believe that there was no psychiatric expert in court to explain why Melanie wasn't present. That may not be correct, but I believe that was the case. So what was this trial of fact?
Right, so the question is, what is a trial of the facts? And of course, the last time we heard about a trial of the facts was with respect to Lord Janner, and here's The Guardian. Lord Janner case, what is a trial of the facts? And it says the defendant cannot put forward a defence. There can be no verdict of guilty, and the court cannot pass sentence. In a trial of the facts, the jury is asked to decide on the basis of evidence adduced by the prosecution lawyers and by lawyers who put forward the case for the defence, whether or not the accused did the facts or he or she, the facts that he or she was charged with. Because the defendant cannot put forward a defence, there can be no verdict of guilty, and the court cannot pass sentence. All the court can do is to make a hospital order, a supervision order, or an order for the defendant's absolute discharge where a finding of guilt is made, but no conviction is registered and no order given. So I think we get a clue in that paragraph what's going to happen here, Brian. But then it goes on to say, such a trial recently took place in the case of former Luton South MP Margaret Moran, who was accused of falsely claiming more than £53,000 in parliamentary expenses. She was given a two-year supervision order. Now, this article about Janner, of course, is from 2015, but I just want to follow that up with the BBC article, Fraud MP Margaret Moran Given Supervision Order. And that says a judge has ruled that the ex-Labour MP for Luton South was unfit to stand trial for mental health reasons and so could not receive a criminal conviction. The jury heard the case at Southwark Crown Court in November in her absence, and she was given the supervision order. And the order is to be supervised by Southampton City Council. So if we go back to the middle paragraph of the Guardian article, Brian, it says all the court can do is make a hospital order, a supervision order, or an order for the defendant's absolute discharge. That's unlikely. The discharge is unlikely to be the case, so it's got to be the other two. If it's a hospital order, then they get what they want, Brian, because that puts Melanie into the psychiatric system, which is where they've wanted her all the while. And of course, that would be, well, indeterminate in terms of length of incarceration.
Yeah.
If it's a supervision order, well, in that case, she would be being supervised by the very local authority that supervised the abuse that she suffered in the first place. Yeah. This is pretty obscene.
The whole thing is obscene, Mike. We'll delve into it a bit deeper, but there's a lot more to come out of this. We have to be fairly measured in our reporting today because some of the information coming forward is limited, and there is some of the information we know, but we can't actually report at the moment, essentially because of reporting restrictions. But let's have a look at what came out of the trial. So we have this. Melanie was found guilty on three charges of arson. One further charge was actually dropped. A charge of sexual assault that had been made against Melanie. This had taken place in one of the prisons. So an inmate, we believe it was an inmate, accused Melanie of sexual assault, but that was dropped. But what was remarkable is that reference was made to this sexual assault charge in key documentation. Now, I think this was part of a statement given by a policeman. Again, I'm saying I believe because we haven't got all of the factual evidence as reported by competent members of the public in the hearing. But I believe it was a police officer had mentioned the sexual assault charge, and the document that he was reading from had been given to the judge and the jury. So essentially a charge had been dropped, but it was still being paraded under the noses of the jury. And the judge got pretty annoyed about this and cleared the court. So the jury had to leave, particular witness had to leave. And then she said, to make it absolutely clear, Melanie is not guilty of that sexual assault charge. So an interesting turn of events, but at least we saw that the judge was taking control. What else can we say? Well, it appears that the jury were not given any significant background to Melanie Shaw as a traumatised abuse survivor, nor of her treatment in prison, and in particular solitary confinement, which we'll speak about a bit more, and other abuses. I'm told that prison staff giving evidence were unable to explain how she had the means to start a fire in her cell, nor could they explain why she was not searched after the first incident, allowing her to start a further fire in her cell 2 days later. I would have said, Mike's my personal opinion, that if somebody started a fire, a prisoner in particular, you fail to search them, giving them the capability to start another fire, this would be criminal negligence on the part of the prison staff. Whether this came into was challenged in court or not, we don't know. Many people have said that the defence barrister put up a pitiful or non-existent defence of Melanie. So let's continue through. What else can we tell you on this case? Well, if we follow the Nottingham Post report, we can see that Melanie has been crying for help for some time. Now, this is where I say the Nottingham Post disingenuous almost, because they report this as if Melanie was saying it in court. But of course, actually, this appears to be coming through as hearsay because it's taken place much earlier and it's being reported presumably by prison warders. So when Shaw was let out of the cell, she said, "I did not endanger anyone. The building is made of steel and concrete." She went on, she said the court heard it caused other prisoners to be moved out of the corridor, and Shaw said, "It's just a peaceful protest." We go on, she blamed the fire on a woman named Lorraine. However, she was the only person present in the cell, the court heard. Is that a sign of somebody who's hallucinating, Mike, or somebody with a split personality?
Could be.
This didn't appear to be part of the evidence heard or dissected in court. I believe the name Lorraine is very significant, but we'll save that for another time. When questioned on her reasons for starting the fire, she said, "My human rights are being abused." When interviewed about the arson in August 2017, Shaw said it was a cry for help. In the interview, she said she had lost the plot and was ill. She said during the interview, "I very nearly died. I lost the plot. I've explained I wanted to die." So here was a woman, disabled, PTSD sufferer as the result of horrific child abuse, being held in solitary confinement for over 18 months. That's a condition which would put many mentally sound people into a very, very bad mental state. She's been denied her medication and drugs. She's been brutalised. But Melanie, unfortunately now unfit, can't appear at her own trial. So let's continue on through. What else can we tell you here? Well, the British state has had her in solitary confinement. Sorry, let's bring it up on screen for 18 months. And of course, she was already in a very, very bad state. Melanie was able for a long time to lead a perfectly good life, but she did need mild medication to achieve that. Since she's been in numerous prisons, that medication has been withheld or interfered with, which would have affected her mental state. She's had denial of contact with the outside world, so she's been prevented from writing letters or receiving letters or having telephone calls, visits with people. All the things that would have helped strengthen this lady's mental state have been blocked. And of course, the prisons have also denied proper psychiatric care and the proper psychiatric medication. Now, this bit doesn't appear to come out, of course, anywhere in the thing, that the prison governor from Stile has been removed. At the moment, there's a wall of silence from the Home Office, but we understand that this is due to the, I've put poor, I'm going to say the perilous state of the prison, with problems, with a vast ballooning of mental health statistics. Women who were not ill when they went to that prison but are now suffering from mental illness. All of this has resulted, we believe, in the prison governor McGuffey being removed. And of course, Melanie's had numerous previous imprisonment, which has also included isolation, denial of medication and medical treatment, including that extremely bad leg ulcer. But it's been coupled with threats and intimidation, which Melanie has been able to tell us about. Will this carry on through? Let's just have a look. Here we are. This is a report from the Manchester Evening News. Now, I'm highlighting that this is a whole series of articles on Stile Prison. The one at the bottom caught my eye. Stile Prison Governor delighted by glowing report from the watchdog. This is the same watchdog that has refused to take any information about the brutalisation of Melanie in Stile Prison or indeed any of the other prisons. But at least the BBC managed to get out one report here saying that the governor of Stile Women's Prison in Cheshire has been suspended while an investigation is carried out into an allegation against her. Now, we don't believe this is one allegation. We believe this is to do with the whole state of the prison. And of course, that would have impacted directly on Melanie Shaw. So if we continue through this, as you've mentioned, Mike, we now believe that Melanie is likely to be transferred to a high-risk psychiatric unit for long-term care as an individual deemed dangerous to the public. And her child abuse testimony and evidence remains totally unheard by ICSA Child Abuse Inquiry. Now, I've got to say, and I find it very upsetting, that there are some people claiming that Melanie's testimony has been submitted to ICSA. I can assure our audience it absolutely has not. And we have dealt with ICSA ourselves. and found that their response with regard to Melanie is a massive "we don't want to know." So this has been reported through this is an email, in fact. This is not just gossip. This is in an email. ICSA is saying we don't need the testimony of Melanie Shaw because we've already heard from others in Beechwood. So we've got the rough idea, Mike. We don't need to hear what Melanie Shaw suffered. And we're also now hearing that some MPs are stating that they have never encountered anything to compare with the wall of secrecy around the imprisonment and brutalisation of Melanie Shaw. Now, a lot of criticism for MPs, but we know there's a small group of MPs that are saying they simply cannot explain what they're encountering, whether they call it unhelpfulness or ignorance, reluctance, refusal, obfuscation. They cannot get the Home Office or the Prisons Minister or any of the other authorities to talk about the Melanie Shaw case. And this, I think, is where it takes us, Mike. I can't reveal the names of the individuals because it's too dangerous for them. Have they provided good information in the past? Yes. These individuals are alleging that ICSA cannot cope with the amount of information coming out about child abuse in Westminster and Ted Heath. And they are predicting that the Westminster part of the ICSA inquiry is going to be shut down in order to protect the government.
And of course, a part of Melanie's potential witness statements to the inquiry would be about Westminster abuses. So if this is true, then what's happening with Melanie? These two situations are linked.
Indeed, because Melanie's testimony, whilst much of it, it's difficult to know how to describe it, we will call it normal abuse. The story links through, as many other of the abuse witnesses have declared, links through to connections with Westminster. So here we have it, that the British Conservative government, standing on the world stage at the United Nations, lecturing other countries on human rights and the fact that they have dictators, that they're locking up journalists in prison. This is the brutal treatment by Theresa May. And let's remember, she was Home Secretary at the time Melanie was imprisoned. We've got a wall of silence by the British government. And I had to smile. Somebody sent this through to me. Theresa May interested in Melanie? No, this is her latest to beef up her image. So absolutely sickening stuff. What will happen to Melanie Shaw? Well, of course, if she ends up in a psychiatric unit on some form of indeterminate sentence, for want of a better word, then Melanie Shaw, of course, has disappeared into the very Soviet gulag that Britain accuses other overseas countries of running. It's sickening stuff, Mike, I think.
Okay, let's move on. Now, many people will have seen this video and many other videos like this of Tommy Robinson in various situations with lots of people around them. And of course, when we look closely at some of them, we find that, in fact, Tommy is holding Free Melanie Shaw posters. Now, I'm very interested about the fact that in some cases, issues issues and subjects that we are talking about, Brian, seem to be being drifted across towards the Tommy Robinson campaign. This type of subject isn't anything that he's campaigned about in the past. So I wonder why that might be.
Well, it's an interesting question, but it's one that I think is concerning a lot of people now. You could say that Tommy Robinson is starting to wake up to what's really going on in the country. It's one thing for him to be standing up on the public stage and bellyaching because he's been brutalised by the police or locked up in prison. But the reality is that this is happening to many, many other people. He picks up on Melanie Shaw, but he's not telling his audience what's happening to her. He's not telling his audience how she's been brutalised. And he's certainly not telling his audience that Melanie Shaw was raped and abused by white abusers, because that doesn't fit Tommy Robinson's agenda that all of the abuse gangs are Asian. So is he doing it out of ignorance, or is he perhaps waking up? Well, I think we're going to find out in the next few weeks, because, of course, if he simply touts the picture of Melanie Shaw but doesn't talk about what's really happening, then he's using it for his own particular political agenda.
Well, look, I'm going to remind people about some of the things we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks, and also some new information here, and maybe it gives us a little bit of insight as to what's going on. Because if you remember, a few days ago, we were talking about Jonathan Allen, who had been speaking at the United Nations Security Council, and he said the UK champions a whole of government, whole of society approach to prevention. He was talking about prevention of terrorism, which is reflected in the newly refreshed counterterrorism strategy contest. When we went to look at the contest, we got this from it. Now, this short quote here, it says, in the UK and Europe, extreme right-wing groups, including neo-Nazis, seek to exploit any anxieties around globalisation, conflict and migration, including any which they're able to link to the Syrian conflict in an attempt to broaden their appeal. Is that what Tommy Robinson's doing? Is he attempting to broaden his appeal by covering issues that he isn't normally covering? But look, what this is a reflection of David Cameron's speech to the United Nations Security Council in 2015. That speech is still available on that's still available on the United Nations General Assembly website if you want to go and look at it, where he expressed his concern about extreme right-wing groups that were sceptical about 9/11 or were sceptical about 7/7 and these kinds of things. And this is a reflection of that. But it also comes to this, because if we go back to Jonathan Allen, of course, he's talking about a whole of government, whole of society approach. This is the fusion doctrine. We've mentioned this a number of times. But what is this? What is he talking about here? Well, look, they've just published this. This is the Ministry of Defence, the Global Strategies, Trends and Future. The future starts today. And they say in this document, states will increasingly need to work in partnership with a range of actors, and those that do so effectively will gain a substantial competitive advantage. So this is a whole of government approach and a whole of society approach. Government working with private sector, NGOs, campaigners, shall we say, and they're going to have a competitive advantage.
And that means money, doesn't it? But to me, I read that, and a competitive advantage means you're getting ahead of other people. Why do you want to get ahead of other people? Because you're going to earn out of it.
Well, absolutely. But this document as well, really about how to maintain the international rules-based order. And of course, they don't want any alternative narratives at all. And what is a better way to shut down alternative narratives but to link alternative narratives to some form of right-wing extremism, and then it can be brushed under the carpet. Now, when this document was published, on Monday, I believe, our Secretary of State for War, Gav the Chav, had this to say. This report makes it clear. We are living in a world becoming rapidly more dangerous. Identifying threats means we continue to build an armed forces that can stay ahead of them. Okay, that's what you say. I don't think that's what you're doing. But anyway, let's move on. This report was written by this organization. This is the Ministry of Defense's think tank, Development Concepts and Doctrine Center. The future starts today. This report says that they are indicating that the world has reached a critical point in the need to tackle the evolution of threats faced in the current climate. The last Strategic Defense and Security Review, they say, published 3 years ago, identified four main areas of threat, including the evolution of extremist terrorism, other things that they're mentioning as well. But in the document itself, they present four potential worlds. Here they are on screen, four potential worlds, and they're asking the question, which one of these four are we moving towards? They're saying that, probably we're moving towards one of these in general with some aspects of the others. And the four options are multilateralism, multipolarity, network of actors, and fragmentation. If we look at network of actors, for example, power is shared between a variety of state and non-state actors. Corporations and megacity leaders are the main non-state actors, but all actors cooperate to address global challenges and provide effective governance. This is an extremely interesting document, and haven't, you know, it's 250 pages long, so haven't read it in huge detail just yet. But look, we're seeing this merger of corporate, NGO,
trust charities,
all this kind of stuff, campaigners and government, and this is extremely dangerous. And here's just one other aspect of it, rubbing shoulders, because, well, city slickers are rubbing shoulders, according to the government, with the public sector. As thousands of civil servants leave Whitehall, they're all moving to Canary Wharf. This is under the guise of saving money. It's part of the One Government Estate programme. Well, here we go. This is what the Minister for Implementation, Oliver Dowden, had to say. It's great to see public and private sector staff rubbing shoulders here in Canary Wharf. So there we go. Moving the civil service into these types of buildings where they can be even closer to their new colleagues in the private sector. This is, if you take this in the round, Brian, as a whole, it seems to me that we have the attack on alternative narratives through the use of, in my opinion, the use of Tommy Robinson and that type of person. Plus, we'll come on to the way the mainstream media is dealing with this a little bit later. But the government, with its fusion doctrine, merging the way government, changing the way government works, the removing the independence of government, removing the separation of powers. This looks is beginning to look very much like some kind of dictatorship to me.
Looks it is, Mike. It is a dictatorship. And of course, what they did, if we think about the old style civil service, we might not have thought it was very efficient, but you could see loyalty to doing a good job for the country. What's happened is they've politicised the civil service. A lot of this work done under Tony Blair and John Prescott. So first of all, it's politicised. Then they've got in the common purpose agenda. That's been driven in. Now we're moving on to the new phase, which is that reframed civil service is now being linked in with big corporate interests. And we will have it in a news in the next few days, but we're having a really in-depth look at what's happening with Britain's defence at the moment. We keep stressing defence because once Britain has lost control of its own armed forces, we don't exist as a nation state. But a very interesting man who's an academic, who's advising the British government and the high levels of the Ministry of Defence and senior military officers, has apparently said that defence is too important to simply be run by a democratic government. So if that's the case, who are the people that are capable of running that defence system? Presumably, this is the big corporate interests that are being pushed via Canary Wharf. And I'm waiting for proof at the moment, but it's also been alleged that this same gentleman has said that a war with Russia is inevitable. So these are pretty dangerous concepts for politics in Britain.
So let's at this point have a quick advertisement for AV 9.1. Democracy in Chains is the title. It's on from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Sunday, the 2nd of December 2018 in the Crown Plaza, London, in Kensington. Well, you'll be speaking at that, as will Graham Downing, Patrick Henningsen, Alex Thompson and Ian R. Crane. Do you know what you're speaking about just yet?
Well, I think it's forming pretty quickly, Mike, because everything we're reporting at the moment is to do with the breakdown of democracy. But I'll keep the rest to a little bit closer.
OK, so anybody wants to know more about that or to get tickets, head over to alternativeview.co.uk. Now, on Monday, we mentioned where we mentioned Jeremy Hunt, believing that because he was in Brussels, of course, to see about getting some new sanctions on Syria over chemical attacks in Syria. And just by coincidence, Brian, as we mentioned on Monday, Panorama on Monday night was running a programme all about chemical attacks that were taking place in Syria. They were saying they believed that 106 chemical attacks took place in Syria. A statement has been issued, and we'll just put it on screen now. This is a statement by the Global Network for Syria. And they're saying a joint investigation by BBC Panorama and BBC Arabic claimed to show how chemical weapons have been used by the Syrian government as part of a deliberate military strategy. Yet there are serious concerns over the investigation's reliance on broadly impartial sources, in quotes, who are not named, and consequently the reliability of the report's findings. The Panorama programme called Syria's Chemical War was first broadcast on Monday the 15th of October on BBC One at 8:30 p.m. So members of the Global Network for Syria have issued the following response. Yesterday's BBC Panorama programme was notable for its omissions. It was not clear, for example, whether evidence backing the claims of 106 uses of chemical weapons came from Syrian rebel sources. Given the sources are not named, the BBC may be relying on evidence from groups that are widely regarded as favourable to the opposition, such as the White Helmets, the Syrian American Medical Society, or the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organisations. The investigation ignored the interim findings of the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on the Douma incident, which contradict the BBC's conclusions. The OPCW found no evidence of the use of prohibited weapons in Douma and did not rule out the chlorine cylinders. Sorry, the OPCW found no evidence of the use of prohibited weapons in Douma, did not rule out the chlorine cylinders found at the site may have been planted. The programme showed former OPCW staff saying that not all of Assad's stocks destroyed under OPCW supervision were necessarily accounted for. It neglected to point out, however, that the OPCW reported in 2014 that it had been unable to visit two sites where chemical weapons were stored, and that both these sites were in rebel-held territory deemed unsafe for inspectors to visit. The programme also claimed to detect a pattern of Assad using chemical weapons in the final stages of sieges, but the report did not address questions raised by numerous military experts who asked why Syrian government forces, which were already winning the war, would deploy chemical weapons of limited usefulness, risking severe reprisals by the US-led coalition. There are further concerns regarding the lack of reference to Islamist fighters who have used chlorine canisters as part of their resistance and who have butchered not just Christians and Alawites, but also hundreds of the civilians living under their control, as documented by the UN. The war in Syria is complex with many different layers to the conflict. It is crucial that any future investigation includes historical and geopolitical context, objective analysis, transparency about sources, and at the very least, an acknowledgement that there are different points of view. And so that was signed by Peter Ford, former ambassador to Syria, Dr. Tim Anderson from the University of Sydney, Lord Kerry of Clifton, Baroness Cox, Lord Gordon of Strathblane, Dr. Michael Langrish, former Bishop of Exeter, and Lord Stoddard of Swinton. And I just thought, Brian, it was worthwhile reading that in full because, the BBC needs to be held to account much more often for the standard of their reporting. The Global Network for Syria hasn't made any comment on the timing of the report. I've made that comment because, it, as I said on Monday, it absolutely reflects the timing of the Saving Syria's Children report. For anybody that isn't familiar with that one, we're going to show the interview we did with Robert Stewart on Saving Syria's Children, if you're watching this on the UK Column live stream, straight after the programme.
Yeah, well, I think BBC brand is completely, we can't even say tarnished. The BBC brand is gone. It's broken. We just hear more and more people who, if you mention the BBC, the first thing they do is sort of give a wry smile. I think the BBC in a couple of months is going to be utterly struggling because its propaganda output is just so blatant. So perhaps a bit of good news there. The worse this stuff gets, the easier it is for people to see what a propaganda machine it is.
Well, hold that thought because we're coming on to that in a moment. Now, in the meantime, Brexit. So here we go. Of course, Theresa May heading over this afternoon to Brussels for the European Council. It's going to focus on Brexit, among other things. But what other things is it going to be looking at? Migration. There'll be a report on progress of migration, as agreed in the June European Council meeting. Internal security. It's going to adopt conclusions on internal security. Now, of course, Brian, we know that with regard to the EU, when they discuss internal security, they're really talking about military unification and so on. This is following the Leaders' Agenda thematic debate in Salzburg on the 20th of September, and also the Euro Summit about the Euro itself is going to be An inclusive format, so Theresa May will be taking part in that, and they're going to discuss the state of play and negotiations on the deepening of economic and monetary union. So I wonder why they'd be discussing that if it's really all about Brexit. But as I say, Theresa is over there to discuss Brexit. And the problem, of course, is the Northern Irish border. The EU says that it's up to the, or this actually, it was Donald Tusk saying that it's up to Theresa May to bring some new ideas to the table because that's the deadlock. Donald Tusk said in October, we expect maximum progress and results at the Brexit talks. Then we will decide whether the conditions are there to call an extraordinary summit in November to finalise and formalise the deal. I predict that is exactly what's going to happen. They're going to pull a rabbit out of the hat at the last minute. We're seeing a lot of theatre and rhetoric at the moment. It's all going to be magically solved. But the question is, how is Theresa May going to present this to Parliament in a way which is going to keep the Democratic Unionist Party on her side? Because ultimately, what she's aiming for, I believe, is some form of words which keeps us within the customs union, but doesn't appear to keep us within the customs union, and doesn't result in a border in the Irish Sea. If the DUP, of course, vote down the budget, which is what they're threatening to do next month, if she doesn't come back with a solution to this problem, then the question then is how long she can remain as Prime Minister, because without their support, she doesn't have a majority.
Chaos and confusion is good, Mike, as far as these people are concerned. If UK can be reduced to a state of chaos, of course they can manoeuvre us in any direction. So Theresa May staying is chaos, going is chaos. Everything goes towards chaos. And we know that was part of the Conservative Party's agenda, because Conservative politicians have told us so. Nick Bowles and Danny Kruger said that the plan of the Tory party was to create what they called creative chaos to get their political agenda. And we're seeing it unfold. I noticed in that film clip at one stage it said that we would become a third state. Was that a third rate state? Because we're just to be a little appendage sort of in Europe and sort of out. But ultimately the Brexit discussion is a lie. It's pure theatre. Because there's one subject that produces terror in all the organisations dealing with it. Well, let's just remind ourselves that on Saturday, just gone, was a Leave Means Leave rally in Torquay. I attended together with Justin Walker from the British Constitution Group and Eddie. And we took some leaflets with us, which were essentially pro-Brexit, but they were certainly very pro-Britain's military. And my goodness, what a result. Let's just have a look at the leaflet here. This is it. What it was talking about was EU military unification, which is the subject, of course, no MP will talk about. So we thought that probably Leave Means Leave rally would be a good place for that subject to be talked about. They hadn't talked about it in the previous two rallies, so maybe Torquay was the place it would happen. But when Justin presented that leaflet to Richard Tice, who is the lead businessman behind Leave Means Leave, he was okay until he saw the very gentle question, will Leave Mean Leave be talking about it? He got very hot under the collar. Nigel Farage, he listened very politely, as is his style, to the question, will you be talking about defence and EU military unification? And then when the individuals who'd handed them the leaflet had moved away, he very casually just pushed that leaflet towards one of his aides. Of course, was defence discussed at the Leave Means Leave rally? No, it wasn't. The most important subject was that our COD quota is going to go up if we achieve Brexit. And also, if you want to know how we're going to deal with the fact we have a European Union dictatorship swallowing Britain, the advice from the panel was that we shouldn't buy French wine. And I'll just leave you on the note that at the end of the day, Justin was forcibly evicted from the conference centre. The event was over. There were just some people talking very nicely in the bar. But four very big thuggish gentlemen ejected Justin Walker out, and they told him in no uncertain terms that the organisers of the event did not want him in the room. What were they frightened of? They're frightened about EU military unification, because this is going ahead despite anything to do with Brexit. It's accelerating under the smokescreen of Brexit. And once our military, that's the Army, Navy and Air Force, plus research and development procurement, are locked into the EU, there is no Brexit. Why do we think that somebody like Nigel Farage would be so frightened of this subject, Mike?
Tell me.
Well, I find it a very interesting question. I have to say that, of course, if you watch what Nigel Farage has done, he abandoned UKIP directly after a key moment when that referendum had been achieved to leave. He will not talk about the state of UK. He will not tell people what the real state of the European Union is. And now we see him refusing to talk about EU military unification. Either he's ignorant of what's going on, or there's some form of deception. Possibly he's been drawn into it. But I've got a lot of questions as to what he does and does not think. We'll have some in-detail coverage of that Leave Means Leave event, and you can hear for yourselves what the security gentleman had to say.
Well, we'll finish on this one, Brian. This is a letter published in The Guardian by the heads of the of ITV, the BBC, Channel 4, Channel 5, STV and S4C. So all the state-run, well, certainly so-called public service broadcasters included in that. And in this letter, they're saying there is a global commercial battle going on to shape and influence what we watch, listen to or buy from the comfort of our homes, whether it's Amazon's search results determining what we buy when we shop online, Facebook deciding what stories and posts we see on social media, or Google controlling the results we search when we search the internet. Global technology firms are shaping our choices and our influences. Technological change is fundamentally changing the way people watch TV. And they are particularly concerned, Brian, they're particularly concerned that public service broadcasting, which they say is essential to our culture because it supports social cohesion, informs our understanding of the world, shapes public debate and contributes to our global soft power. It's also vital to our democracy, reaching tens of millions of people each week with high quality, accurate and impartial news covering events in the world around them and at home and abroad. In an era of fake news, echo chambers and social media filter bubbles, Ofcom data tells us that TV remains the most important and trusted source of news for UK citizens. So, we've mentioned mainstream media and their position and how they view themselves a few times on this programme. We get an even better clue from this letter that they've decided to publish in The Guardian. They want to make sure that the big service providers like Netflix, like Virgin or Sky, make sure that the BBC, ITV and Channel 4 are right at the top of the listings, and that that's the first place you go to get your news. Rather than any other alternative news outlet, they've got to be right there in front in people's faces, or else.
Yeah, but I think there's a bit of fear coming here, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll end on that subject in view of the fact it's essentially good news. Is the BBC beginning to wobble? Yes. Why? Because people are simply now saying we don't believe what you have to tell us. So spread the word. This evening is the UK column meeting in the George Hotel Plimpton. So if you're local or can come along, we'd be delighted to see you. And I'm going to say a big thank you to people who've given the UK column donations and taken out subscriptions in the last few days. Very encouraging to see. If you're still watching us essentially for free, please consider taking out a subscription, because you can help us expand what we do. We'll leave it there. Remember Melanie Shaw. Really, Melanie's only chance of surviving from here on is for her to be under the watchful eye of the general public 24 hours per day. Do we think she's in a perilous position? Absolutely. And remember what we've said about the British government's attempt to cover up the abuse of children. There is no question that this is happening. and accelerating. We'll leave on that note. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.